opposed to Scary Terry.
Scary Terry, bitch!
Welcome to... What are you guys talking about?
What are you guys talking about?
All right, well, welcome back to the podcast. I was yammering on again, and Ed was like, we've started recording now. Could you get on with the announcement? I'm like, Can we just? And we've got,
you
know,
the magic words?
So we're recording with Adam Stovall tomorrow. He won't hear from him for a while because we're putting up his podcast with us right before he has his next premiere in the UK. But Adam, like, and Adam, I know you listen to these things now. I think you do because you really want to come on my podcast. And I was like, I'm turning red over here. You can't, Ed is the only one who can see it. But I just was so chuffed by the whole thing. Like, this is really just Ed and I's hour and a half rants about whatever the studio is working on, whatever we wanted.
Forgetting people's names.
Spider-Man Homecoming, thank you very much to everyone who laughed through that one while we could not remember anyone's name, you know?
Or John Watt.
At least I was sober for that one. I can't speak for Eddie, but I was sober for that one, you know? I'm not sober for all of them, I'll be honest, but I was sober for that one. So, at any rate, thank you all for joining us again. Today is kind of the end of the MCU discussion, for now. But it is a big part of what I'm doing, and I have more things to say about the MCU. Before we get into all that, brass tacks, I always do, and I'll do it quick. Again, you're listening to us via SoundCloud. I do believe shortly we will be moving to Anchor FM, because just about everyone's on Anchor FM now, and it's free. So I can drop the money I pay SoundCloud per year for what we host there and get it from Anchor for free. So we will be moving to Anchor probably in the next couple of weeks. That doesn't mean anything to you, because Anchor automatically puts us on all the podcast platforms. So that's another reason we'll be moving onto that. But for now, you can catch us on SoundCloud. SoundCloud is still probably where we'll keep some of the hosting for at least the rest of this year. So you're still welcome to use the playlist there. Come check us out. But eventually we'll be moving over to Anchor FM. Please also check us out on social media. I am constantly posting on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, whatever. Just check out our different stuff there. The biggest way to get a hold of us, and the best way, and we have had some good page visits over the past 2 weeks, I've been catching up with that, is www.lawvictoriaproductions.com. That is always being updated now. There's so much we're working on, and I'm just so proud of it all, Ed. Like, it's getting so much bigger than it was when we started everything. So as the producer and the guy, you know, who works with Ed to get this all moving, it really just makes me very happy. If we continue on in this directory, I'm very hopeful that Ed and I will kind of realize the dreams we have of making that, you know, $1 million, you know, independent film that gets people's attention and puts us on the map. And you know, we're also very happy with those of you that listen to the podcast, those of you that are with 3020, you know, those of you that have been listening intently for our new show, and those of you that read the blog posts. So it's just nice to have the community that we do and the people who care about kind of what we're saying.
Amen.
So with that in mind, I have been talking to you about a blog post about the Defenders, and I've decided to can it. I say it all the time. The reason this one's getting canned is this. So I was about to lay out in exact detail to you why I am so unhappy with Netflix, because I really think they have good shows that they're not giving attention to or not promoting the right way. Or I just think this was thought out poorly, and that Jeff Loeb, again, it's the brunch. Jeff Loeb, Kevin should have sat at a brunch and figured out what they wanted to do. And to be honest, you know, and I'm not Mr. Loeb, so please don't get mad, but I would have just listened to Kevin and just done what he wanted, because Kevin has had vision on this. And that's how these things go sometimes. You got to follow the visionary. You know what I mean? Take it from a guy who hates admitting it when I don't have the best idea in the room. If someone has the best idea in the room, just go with it. So what has changed that, though? The Punisher. Wow. Just wow, guys. Like, everything and anything I wanted from the Punisher. And I'm a guy who's, you know, I don't talk to them as much, but many of my old best friend is a Marine vet, did 2 tours in Afghanistan. A lot of my friends from back home are in the Marines. I never did. God knows, you know, just listening to my podcast, you realize, well, I never went to the Marine, but they were good soldiers and they fought hard. And man, does the Punisher really, really, really well encapsulate what it's like to be a veteran and come back.
What episode are you on?
I'm on the 5th episode, I believe. The 6th one. Okay. He's just taken the FBI spoiler.
I'd like us to revisit this conversation when you're done with it, because I do have feelings about the Punisher.
Okay. I mean,
but it requires you to watch the whole season.
Cool. I mean, the ultra violence thing, just to give my feelings on that, I looked at it and was like, wow, people are going to get mad about this, but that's how the comic book was. That's why we all read the comic book. The whole point of the comic book was, it was, you know, in my time, When I was a kid, it was about a Vietnam vet. Your parents didn't want you to read it because it was that violent, because he just killed everybody and didn't care. And he was the only one who did that. Everybody else had a code, and he has a code. It's just his code does not involve, like, his special power is that he doesn't care about killing people. Like, that's pretty much his special power.
And John Barenthal is some pretty damn good casting.
That is the Punisher, right? The main character?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I thought sometimes it's really interesting you say that, and I'm sorry we've kind of segued into a discussion about the Punisher, because we're going to get to something else.
I mean,
in a
it's
minute.
All things MCU.
Exactly.
Right?
We're going to get to the main
part
MCU.
Part two of all things MCU.
So, but the thing with him is, you know, I loved him in Walking Dead. Just absolutely loved him in Walking Dead. And he's in it for the good stuff. The whole problem I have with Walking Dead is they ran it for. It's still running, I think, to a certain extent with spinoffs. Like, but the first five seasons, really the first four seasons, are the ones that I remember. We stopped watching after like season six, but not because it was bad. It just went on for too long.
Yeah,
like,
same.
Again,
same, exactly
I think
same.
What the series creators on that were unfortunate. Like, producers on that will say, we'll have to make money. Unfortunately for me, being like a writer on that, I would have said series fatigue, man. Like, people don't want to be in a zombie apocalypse for 11 seasons. Like, it's just not what they want to do. You know what I mean? So, oh well. You know what I mean? But his character was just perfect. Like, perfect. Mm. Now, he's playing essentially the same guy again as the Punisher. He has the same drawl, the same accent. And the reason I say that is these guys are like guys I grew up with. Like, these are, if you came back home with me, guy would be talking like him, acting like him. You know, these are my dudes. Like, and they're completely different from me. They always have been, but that's what Midwestern, you know, military boys are like. You know what I mean? They have that drawl. They're really.
But I think what one thing that surprised me about the show was how contemporary it felt, because obviously, you know, the Punisher, the comics, at least as far as I know, and I'm no expert, was a little bit of a reaction to kind of Vietnam veterans and the kind of the carnage and stuff that that they saw.
Yeah,
and you know, this I felt that this iteration of it was it was pretty damn good. I thought it was really, really well done.
It works because, I mean, it's you know, it's all the subcultures that you're part of that you don't know you're part of. Okay, like, you know, like my sister used to do some entertainment and stuff like that, so I have that whole subculture of people that I hang out with that, you know what I mean, like, that I wouldn't know otherwise, but because of her. So military veterans, like, it's a story that always needs to be told, Ed, and that never is. Veterans, like, don't get me wrong, it's very noble for someone to go up and fight for my country. And we are a military, you know, whether you want to admit it or not, America is a military country. Like, we send loads of troops in, more so than lots of other people. And it's a great career for young people. But as it always stands, man, they always get thrown in the cannon fodder. And so you have people who come home and they're told all this propaganda before they go out there just so they can shoot the other side, and it never quite works out that way. So most of my life, Ed, I have known veterans not just because of, you know, not just because of my own friends, but because of my stepfather who was in Vietnam. And so, yeah, man, I mean, Punisher, the other half of Punisher, and some of the movies that have come out about that, it's not like it's never been told in cinema, but about like that. They come home, man, and like, I don't know. It's for me, it was easy to picture. You're one day you're told it's okay to be vicious and kill people, and you have to because your friends are dying, and you got to make sure that you're not going to die like everybody else, and that you get as many of your friends out as possible.
Right, you go survival mode, right?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, into soldier mode. You know, that's what soldiers are supposed to do. That's what we train them to do. That's why we send them out there to do that. And you know, people may not agree with the violence itself, but you know, from a job function, Ed, that's what they're told to do. Like, that's your job description is, you will go to Iraq, you will shoot at people, you will protect the Americas. You know, they're just doing their job. And they come home to a lot of problems. You know, A, no one, they expect people to take care of them when they come home because they've been taken care of by the military. And the military usually just drops them after a while because, you know, there's all sorts of issues that come up. You know, society in general, like, to give you a perfect example, the first time my best friend came back from, you know, it was his first tour of Hallelujah. He did two. His first tour of Hallelujah, he went to meet me in college because that was my sophomore year in college when he came back. And as he came to see me, like, I remember he parked in the parking lot, man. And as he came out, like, he was spit on by protesters and stuff like that. And don't get me wrong, man, like, I'm uber liberal. He knows. And he knew that. Like, I don't believe in war. I think the whole thing's stupid to begin with. However, when you got a mate who went out there and got shot at for you, you're like, don't do that to him. Like, that's not cool. And it doesn't stop, man. So the stories you're hearing in The Punisher, the modern take on it, that's why I love it so much. That's real. The kid that sleeps in the tent, I've got a buddy who does that. Okay? Mm. The guy who shot at his dad, like, I got another buddy who did something similar to that. Like, it happens. It happens a lot. And so, you know me, like, when you give people a voice that way, I just think it's beautiful. And it's so well balanced that I think it's even more beautiful because of that. Like, because you have, you know, kind of two sides of that story. And I'm talking especially about the confrontations that have over the kid sleeping in the bunker and, like, his different views on what he should be doing, their views on how he is. There's this tone to military people that I love because, like, they can be mean and there's no need for an apology. Like, I don't know if that makes sense, but, like, it is what it is. Like, there's never any, like, that wasn't fair. Like, it's like, doesn't mean anything. It's the military. I don't agree with that at all. As I said, hence why I never went into the military, because I wouldn't have survived 5 minutes. But yeah. Anyways, that's The Punisher, man. I think I've put Ed to sleep over there. He's like, are you going to keep going on about veterans? So, but that's why I love it so much. And that's why I canceled saying that the Netflix series were crap, because I've got to watch them in full now to the end.
Gotcha.
And then I will come back with a larger article. The short article I'm going to do either tonight or tomorrow, because I just finished that, will be on The Inhumans. The question will be, was it even worth a single season?
Oh, yeah.
And I'll
see. Yeah, because you were pretty all right about it at first. I was like, oh, well, I guess I have to give it a go. But then by the end of it, you were like, oof. This is this is like a bridge too far.
It had peaks and troughs, and I think it ends on a peak, so fine, but, you know.
Okay, well, let's get into Guardians Volume 2, because I think they do kind of connect a little bit in terms of the Inhumans kind of space wacky, a little bit of the space wackiness that Marvel has.
No, there is a direct connection. This is, you know, MCU buff on the line here. So the Inhumans are created by Kree crystals. So Kree crystals, the Kree were the race that you met in the first Guardians of the Galaxy.
Right.
So all Inhumans,
who are also like a really big part of Captain Marvel, which, you know, you're
correct, because Captain Marvel is Kree, if I remember correctly, or he's at least related to Kree. So the whole point being, like, the Kree did experiments on humans, and that created the first Inhuman, and this is all talked about in S.H.I.E.L.D. So that's where I learned all this. But these guys are part of, you know, a branch of that, you know, spaced out, went to the moon, and it's all about them. So it is all connected. And thanks for the Guardians of the Galaxy thing. Yeah, the reason we're talking about this was the third of the awesome movies in part one of Phase 3. So I just wanted to encapsulate them all, because I watched them all within about 3 weeks of one another. And to be fair, I'm not sure I want to talk about it that much, because when I talked to Eddie, he said he had feels about this one. So, Eddie, hello.
Hello.
Let's start with some of those feels. Tell me about your experience watching this. Let me shut up for a while.
How spoilery are we getting at this point?
As I said, with the MCU stuff, mate, it's so readily available. Okay. Spoilers. And now, if you don't want to hear them, you turn off, you go away, and come back after you watch the show. So,
cool. I really loved this film the first time I went. I went to the IMAX in Waterloo. I lined up for this, like, you know, silly, like, photo booth thing, where you would get green screened in with the Guardians of the Galaxy.
I think, like, I might still have the picture. This was during your era of when you were like, he used to love to do this while I was at work. He'd be like, hey man, look at me, I just went to this new show. And I'm like, fuck you.
Back when we could do that.
I'm not jealous.
But I was really swept up in the whole, like, just the cinematic experience, and it really is a fantastic cinematic experience. The opening sequence alone is well worth the money of going to watch it at the theater. But honestly, this time round, watching it, I was a little bit more up and down on it. I wasn't paying attention at certain points. Certain points felt like they dragged. But by the end, man, it did exactly what it did the first time round. I was in tears. I think that
what is it, you know, like I said, because I know how I feel about all this, but man, like, as I said, I took about 15 minutes that first part bit there. But I really do want, because I think you'd be good at explaining it, what is it about this film that you love so much? You know what I mean? What is it?
Okay.
What is it that it does? Why does it make you cry at the end?
Well, first of all, I think that it has a real sense of adventure in a way that, like, I think Indiana Jones has, and the kinds of like films that we grew up loving, whether it's your Star Wars, is your
agreed
your indies.
It has that, and I mean it's not just the ones we grew up loving. It's part of like what I love about Greek tragedy or Greek epic. Like it has a pacing. Indiana Jones, Raiders of the Lost Ark is probably the best of the three, only because that pacing never stops. Like it literally starts mm-hmm. with one action scene and runs. And like the closest thing we have now, and I was going to ask you if we should do this for the latest script that I showed you, but is the one shot. You know what I mean? Like that's the
single take.
That's the new version of the moving action. But back in Raiders, like that was the quickest thing you had, you know, was like movie starts, we're running, we're going blue, 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 blue. And there's lots of movies that have replicated that. You know what I mean? I told you Pirates of the Caribbean 2 is another one. It has that continuous pacing, but it was too long. Yeah. It was like 2 hours and 20 minutes, and so you have to have them a bit shorter for that. Anyways, keep going, my good man.
But like I said, this time round, I felt my concentration kind of waning a little bit as the film went on, and I think it's because, like you're saying, those films that have this kind of relentless kind of pacing to them and energy. It can be a little bit one note. It can be like a constant 11.
Mm.
And you kind of need it to lay off. And for some reason, I didn't feel like Guardians 2 was doing that. Or when it did, it felt a little bit boring.
Mm.
But I think that what got me at the end was the characterization of Peter Quill and these individuals who are, you know, dregs of society kind of thing, including Yondu, who was technically like a bad guy in the first one, right?
Mm.
Like, again, spoilers, but his death had me in absolute bits.
Oh, I think everybody. I mean, it is such a wonderful... And the actor on that... The thing I loved when I did all the behind-the-scenes stuff that you know I do, and God knows it's James Gunn, so I was, like, taking so many notes, because I just think the guy's genius and really funny. But the dude who plays Yondu, which I've opened Wikipedia here so we can look it up, so we don't start
Rourke.
So we don't start butchering everyone's name again. I always love how Vin Diesel, by the way, is listed in this, and like even when he's on like doing the behind the scenes stuff, you can totally tell he like shows up and then like does his 10 bits and leaves, like promotes the hell out of the film. But
he's so into it though.
He loves it. No, that's what I mean. He's the promotion machine. But as far as like being on set, he's like
So it's the guy who played Yondu, I think his surname is Rourke.
It's just, sorry, I'm just pulling it up here. So, and I just passed Vin Diesel is why I was thinking about that, though. The Meredith Quill, Lord of Haddock, Seth Green is the voice of Howard the Duck. That's funny to me.
Yeah.
Howard the Duck still making the rounds. Ended up in Marvel after a while. They put him in a movie, if I remember correctly. Yeah. That was the famous George Lucas film, right?
Oh, dude. That's a film we should have a talk about.
Really? I've never watched
Howard. Holy crap. Oh, my
God,
man. It is fucking awful.
Really?
Yeah, it's so bad. There's this really inappropriate sex scene between the duck and the main actress, which is just so wrong.
Is it like post Me Too? Would it be? So, let me tell you, I was watching Scream, and now Scream being especially appropriate because Rose McGowan's in it, and this is, I think, and sorry, Rose, you know, I haven't seen you in a long, long time, but I think this is when she says everything happens, like when everything goes wrong, and Jesus, her characterization in that film clearly was like, but watching Scream post Me Too is a bit difficult because there are all these scenes with the boyfriend that are like, what's up with the sex?
Yeah,
like,
why
have sex with me? Why not
put out,
you know? Yeah. And it's like, and then there's no like thought to it. It's just, that's how it is.
No. It was very much, it was very normal back then, man. It was very like, yeah, sure.
I just kept looking at my wife who like, she had requested we watch. We ended up buying the trilogy on Apple Store. And I was just like looking at her like, this is weird, right? She's like, no, it's still good though. I'm like, no, it's still really good. But like this commentary. And then Rose McGowan is wearing like the tightest shirt possible. You know what I mean? Like,
I think she's in a Catholic schoolgirl outfit.
She is, with her like nipples sticking out, and I'm like, that poor girl. Like, no girl would want to wear that anyway because it looks so horribly uncomfortable. But then it was like,
I mean, there you go, man. Like, that was definitely the time. definitely the
time. Oh, man. Great film, though. Still a great film. Yeah. Despite its, you know, pre-Me Too problems, you know, like, wow, man. I was just trying in my head, trying to write the new one, being like, how would you do this now? How would you make fun of Scream now? Mm. And I will, Wes Craven, rest in peace, and then we'll make it. So the dude, his name, by the way, is Michael Rooker. And once I heard that, I was like, of course I would remember that name. Like, Michael Rooker, because he is a really talented actor. He's in a lot of other stuff as well.
He was also in Walking Dead in the first season.
I believe so. Yeah, he's the cousin. He's the brother.
He's the brother.
And like I said, man, I love that, because that's hillbilly. That's dude I grew up with.
And he was in Mallrats as well. He's the guy who got the stink bomb.
He was, and he's in every one of James Gunn's films. James and him are like really good friends.
That's
like
awesome.
Rooker goes over to his house for dinner. So, and that's where the stuff I love hearing. Because to me, guys, just so you know, if you ever become part of my film world and film crew, and Ed can attest to this, like that's me. Like that's why I love film, because it's not just people I meet at work. It's like people who want to come over to my house and have some dinner with me and shoot the shit for a while. Like. That's what I love about filmmaking, is you have people that actually generally like working with each other, not shitting on my day job, but obviously like those types of jobs just aren't as personable. We did have a quiz on Friday and it was fun, but you know, not the same.
But yeah, Michael Rooker, just absolutely spectacular. And the funeral of Yondu at the end when the Ravagers show up and James Gunn's brother has that moment where he's like screaming at the porthole. When the Ravagers arrive is so cool.
But,
it's so cool.
But you brought up an equally good moment that I was really surprised about. And sorry to interject. I just want to throw it in before I completely forget about it. How brutal, though, was when they kill his crew?
Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Like, it was really dark all of a sudden. I was like, fuck, man, they've just killed everyone. Like, I like that.
And I think, I think perhaps, you know, this is something that we've talked about with the Korean movies in the past, where the absurd and the melodramatic can coexist and work quite well. And I think James Gunn is able to blend, you know, he's definitely got a sense of humor. But there's a lot of emotion in his characters.
Oh yeah. I would agree. Know. It's everything with that is a spectrum. So going on to what we're talking about, guys, the easiest way I could tell you to see some different versions of that is to watch the Vengeance trilogy. So that's Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance. That is Old Boy, the one that became most famous. And then Sympathy for Lady Vengeance. And each of these films is your traditional Korean drama where they'll twist and turn the story. I mean, if you haven't watched them as a filmmaker, what are you doing? You know what I mean? Like, they're brilliant. And they're by Park Chan-wook, which is probably, next to Bong Joon-ho, now one of the most famous, you know, Korean directors of all time. But what am I getting at? Well, Old Boy's a great example. Old Boy has to blend a certain amount of comedy in with the surreal, because it's just so hard to believe what's going on. You're talking about a guy, spoiler alert, you're talking about a guy who's locked in a room for like 10 years, is it? Is it 10 years or 20 years?
15.
It's freaking ever, you know what I mean?
It's a really, really long
time. And so
time.
There's going to be some funny stuff that happens as a result of that. However, the whole situation itself is not that funny. So they blend humor. Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance, certainly. That's all about a mistaken death, and that has dark comedy written all over it. So that's the funniest. The middle's probably the second funniest. And then Sympathy for Lady Vengeance. The comedy in Sympathy Lady Vengeance is only there so that you don't just absolutely retch and cry the entire film, because it is so depressing when you figure out what's going on. And not in a bad way. It's a way that compels you to continue watching, but it is a tragedy. It is a tragedy. You know what I mean? So the comedy keeps you from walking out of the cinema and saying, I just can't take any more of this. You know, query, and please don't butcher me on Facebook with this, okay? But query... I'm just thinking of some that I've had a really hard time getting through. Query whether comedy in The Handmaid's Tale, or I wouldn't say Nightingale, because the whole point was not in The Nightingale, was to do it without any comedy, to do it straight like, because of the, and maybe that's The Handmaid's Tale too, because they're like, it has some direct, you know, conversations about the way we treat women. It you know, that was the good part about watching it. It was so educational as to kind of just how assertive as men we are over a woman's life. And like, you know, I have a tough wife who doesn't put up with that shit, but even she will get laid on by me many a time, you know, with me doing the misogynistic bullshit, not realizing. So, you know, Handmaid's Tale, boys.
It's an interesting point, though. I mean, you know, this is obviously, I think perhaps that's maybe one of James Gunn's greatest assets, and maybe one of the reasons why he was you know, pegged as the guy who would take on the Marvel space cinematic universe and kind of become, you know, one of the brain trusts of Kevin Feige's. But he does seem to also understand how to appeal to a very, very large audience. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I don't mean like lowest common denominator. I'm talking about like family issues. I'm talking about friendship. I'm talking about found family. I'm talking about the things that are very, very universal. And, you know, to put it in that nice, entertaining, bombastic, adventurous, super colorful, right? Because, you know,
The way they've got Guardians now, and the reason probably why it's one of my favorites on there is it represents kind of what I think is our changing views of family, which becomes so trite every time I hear the news say it or something else. You know, Ed and I are both examples of that. Our parents are both divorced and remarried. We're both multicultural, you know, we're mixed. But the problem is, I think for a vast majority of my life, I have felt that people just paid lip service to all that. In other words, especially growing up in the American Beauty suburbs that I did, wow, like having divorced parents, having parents from a different part of town, my parents are both New Yorkers living in Cincinnati, being mixed race, like, as much as people always told you it's okay, everybody matters, like, it didn't really feel that way most of the time. It kind of felt like you were always the odd duck. Movies like this, and I'm not alone in that. Jesus Christ, there were a million other people that felt that way. You know, billions probably. But movies like this are, I think, the new. You know what I mean? It's showing, like, we have reached critical mass. These are the families we need to celebrate. And that's why so many people can get behind this. Because it doesn't matter if your dad's blood related to you or if the guy... You know, like, Ed and I aren't related, but I consider him like a brother. You know what I mean? He's probably closer to me than some of my own family, unfortunately. So that's kind of the new world we live in. And that's difficult when we went through the 50s and 60s of traditional family values that have just been, you know, bludgeoned over everyone's head. Will we get past that? Well, I think Guardians of the Galaxy is a perfect example that the answer is yes. I think.
Yeah, I think it is definitely embracing the kind of new family, the found family, you know.
It's a progressive vision, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
And I think that's why it works so well.
Yeah. Okay, so how did you feel about first of all, Mantis? I'm very curious about
this. I tell you what, I'll talk about Mantis only because I know what you're gonna say, because I know what she looked like, so I don't really need to hear your commentary about how pretty she was. I know you.
Pom Clientief, I think is her name.
That's right. I think she's Canadian.
She's French Canadian, but her mother's Korean.
and he hasn't done any other research for this show, but I knew he'd know everything about this girl.
No, yeah, I definitely looked her up.
She is a really good actress. She knows her timing. She got the comedic timing perfectly.
It's funny because at first, again, I struggled a little bit with her. I was like, oh, they take it like, okay, because Drax is a certain kind of humor that I think really grew on me in the first Guardians. He, to me, was the funniest thing in the first Guardians, right? And I was worried that they were trying to kind of replicate that and add more of it. But by the end of it, they complemented each other so well.
That's right. So,
and it was brilliant.
It's showing you, they're what I would call like Taoist characters. So Taoist, you know, and I won't go into too long of a rant about this, but I am a Taoist, if you didn't know. My favorite Taoist book is The Tao of Pooh. And that's
yes,
not, that's not
I
poop,
love that
that's
book.
Pooh. Because, you know, the Tao is, the Tao,
what is it, the Tao of Pooh and the Tao of Piglet, right?
Because it all comes from the Tao Te Ching. And listen, it's not that complicated. It's a very simple philosophy of accepting life of what it is. In other words, the story that was told to me out east and the reason I fell in love with it and I still practice it, you know, practice the thought process on it to this day is a guy who told me the story about, there's a famous story about a, you know, elderly man, 250 years old, that's, you know, China style, they live that long apparently back then, you know, falls into the Yangtze River, their great raging river, and goes, you know, from the top of it. And he's chased by two men are trying to get him out, but they can't catch him. And he goes all the way through these rapids and down. And they're like, oh, my God, he must be dead. And then he just comes out at the bottom of the river. And the two men are like, what? And so he comes up to the two men and he talks to the guys. He says, you know, they ask him, of course, they say, well, what happened, man? How in God's name did you survive that? How in everybody's name did you survive that? He's like, I didn't resist. And so the Tao is the idea of not resisting what is in front of you, taking things at face value. And I really do believe people should do that more often because, you know, especially deep dive Jason, it tends to be one of my problems is I overanalyze everything. So if you start not doing that, then you become, in my view at least, and I could be completely wrong on this, but in my view, someone like Drax, you know, who just like, haha, you're in pain. You have sexual feelings for this girl. Like, he doesn't know any better. Like, he's just saying how he feels. Like, you know, he's not trying to hurt anybody.
Like, when he's a wretch, he's like, oh, I'm imagining myself being with you physically.
Exactly. Oh. Instead of like that long buffer, which, you know, God knows is probably why I like him, because I don't have that buffer either. But that long buffer that people put between what's going on and what they're saying, it's like, no, it's just he just, you know. And he's very happy. Yeah. He's like, I want to kill these people that hurt my family. I want to, you know, the opening. I love it. Like, oh, his outside casing appears to be weak. I must jump inside. And they're like, how is that any better?
I defeated it. When he comes out as well, he thinks
he's always
like
happy.
One.
He's always like, yay. Yeah.
No, he's brilliant. And I think that Mantis was actually a really good addition. Okay.
So your question. What did you think of your favorite dude, Kurt Russell, as Ego?
Yeah, I loved him. I think he was so good.
He's like, oh, he's so cute.
He was so good. Like, first of all, the de-aging thing, like, it freaks me out every time I watch
really
it.
Really good, right?
When it's done well, yeah, and it's done well.
They've done it twice. They've done it with Robert Downey, and now they've done it with him, so, you know.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But he's just so charming, and like he's like when Quill is like he says, oh, are you a god, and he's like, small g, son. I just that kind of cool, you know, Kurt Russell-y kind of suaveness, which is brilliant. And actually he turns out to be a great villain at the same time.
That's what I was gonna ask because I, you know, I think people had feelings about this. I was not on the fence. I generally lean towards you saying I think he was cast right for that. But what do you think? I do the problem you do have is putting him in the villain thing. Is he too jokey to be this world destroyer, but this universe destroyer? Really, I didn't think so, but I don't know. What would you say to that? Do you think the remote? Do you think he gets the tone right at the end?
I think he does get, well, okay. I think there's small moments where it jumps the shark just a little bit.
Okay.
Like the Pac-Man moment, for example, was perhaps half an inch too far for me. But then it brought it back very quickly. And again, the central idea, and this is what I always kind of, when I look at villains and I say, is he a good villain? Is he or she a good villain or a bad villain? I tend to think about, do they have a point, right? Like, do they have a perspective, a point of view? And I think, again, I've talked about this on the podcast before, but the best example of this is Killmonger from Black Panther. You know, where you can almost be like, okay, like this guy, he has a very, very good point.
You're talking about Andy Serkis's character, right? That's Killmonger.
No. Killmonger is the main bad guy.
Michael B. Jordan.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That makes more sense. I kept talking. You were talking about Andy Serkis. I'm like, but he's only in the film minutes.
Yeah.
I haven't watched it yet. So again.
Yeah.
No, I definitely hear you because it makes it easier, doesn't it? It's the Magneto, the Magneto Xavier thing.
Yes, exactly.
Principal villain.
And I think it's easy to fall into the, oh, I'm just evil for evil's sake. I think Hela, kind of dropped into that a little bit in Thor Ragnarok.
I would disagree with you heavily on that one, but I'll save that if you want me to for, you want me
go
to
on,
explain?
Go on.
So, no, I mean, and remember again, like, I've seen all these, I think I saw Thor 3 times, like, because I loved it that much. I was like, I'll watch the Darkness commentary again, it was so good. But in the story, I think the way that Hela works well is because, and again, it just depends on how much you're into the whole Nordic Thor mythology, but the whole point with Hela is that she comes in and she represents what Odin was before. and what Odin is never telling people about. Now, I know about this as well because I love Norse mythology. So, yes, I mean, the MCU kind of portrays Thor and Odin as these really good guys. The Norse mythology doesn't say that per se. They feared the gods the same way the Greeks feared the gods. These were not necessarily benevolent. Did I say that right?
Mm.
People. Yeah. Like, they aren't. Like, they're not like God. Mm. Like, not how we have a Judeo-Christian belief in God. They're just beings with immense power. And so Thor, you know, if you read his mythology, is a bit of an asshole, really. And that's how the MCU kind of got its swagger with that, because they said, okay, we'll take the myth from there and just make him a big asshole, make him learn something. So Hela represents when the gods, because there's two different types of Nordic gods too. There's the Aesir gods and the Vanir gods. And if you want to learn all about this, play God of War. It will teach you a bunch of this stuff. But basically the Vanir gods are where kind of calm down the Aesir gods. The Aesir gods are Odin and Thor and his children, and they're very violent. And Hela is part of that contingent. And those are the ones that go out and conquest. They don't ask questions. They're Vikings as we know Vikings. They go, they rape, they pillage, and they take them back home with them. That's you know, why do you always have beautiful people in Sweden? Well, the theory is the Vikings took all the pretty girls, brought them back to Sweden. So, sorry. Hela, in my view, then, is a more measured villain because of that. Because she's the one that rips the ceiling off and points out to Thor, who she's fighting, saying, you're part of, you know, you're part of lies. Your father lied to you, you know, and it does fit with the progression that happened in the second movie, where the second movie was, again, lies. You know what I mean? You're not really. And even the first film, lies because of Loki. Second film, lies because of the Dark Elves. Third one, lies because of Odin hid the fact that he took over the Nine Realms by force and that he's subjugated. I mean, nothing more than a powerful message today, where we get pissed at our prime minister or our former prime ministers and other presidents and other people that have done this to people and said, you know, we can't worship, you know, Winston Churchill the way we used to because he put people in Kenya into concentration camps. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
That's why I think she is a more balanced villain and it has a better presence.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, I could see that. Then I guess maybe a better example would be, I mean, if you've seen Wonder Woman, the original Wonder Woman.
Oh, God, Ares. Yeah. Who is the... Yeah, is that the original?
Yeah, exactly.
And this is the problem. No, I'm totally with you, because this is the problem I had with Phase 1 MCU and most of the DC, you know, universe stuff. Like, because they do, like you said, they field really, really weak villains. Think of Phase 1. So Iron Man, you know, that's played by Jeff Bridges, a great actor that they completely, like, waste. Like, he's just this idiot. Yeah,
totally.
You know, here, you're talking about the Big Lebowski. And they make him into this kind of like...
Is it Ironmonger? Is that his name?
No, Ironmonger's in a different one. But okay. Which one's Ironmonger? Ironmonger's in... No, I'm thinking of the Blacksmith. I'm watching The Punisher. No, you're right. Maybe it is Ironmonger. So...
Anyway, a little bit forgettable, even though it's Jeff Bridges, who's an amazing actor.
And Iron Man 2, again, has great actor.
Whiplash.
Then Whiplash, a great, great villain that they just didn't do anything. So the Incredible Hulk, next great example, you have a great villain. You have, you know, the Hulk's biggest bad guy that he always fights, the plague the aberration. Something like that. It's I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm forgetting it offhand, but you know, completely forgettable in the movie because it's another amazing actor. It's
God. And I don't think Ego was forgettable.
No,
I think he's very memorable.
That's why I'm like,
and you know,
that's why I'm saying we got a podcast about these, because this is what I'm telling you. If you're not a fan of the MCU, if you're like, man, I've watched Marvel films and they bore me, like these are the ones I would say going to all the way to the end of Phase 3. These are the ones to watch. These were the ones where they hit a peak. They're going to do the best they've ever done with the writing. You know, I'm very excited to see kind of the ones I haven't seen, which is Ant-Man and Wasp. I never saw. And Infinity War. I mean, I've watched Infinity Wars, but I haven't watched, obviously, Thanos' defeat and Endgame. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, there's still a little bit to watch there. And I definitely think, you know, the villains have gotten better over time. The last weak villain that I can remember, and it's why I didn't like the film, was Doctor Strange. Like, great villain. That was like the cosmic bad guy that was going to break into reality. I mean, he literally is from another dimension. And it's just, there's no character really there. There's just a special effect. And kind of a voice. And it's like, that's why Ego, like you're saying, is so infinitely better, because they were like, we need to visualize this. They just matched the right celebrity to the right villain. Like, you know, Kurt Russell's persona, at least, you know, the other one to cast would have been the joke that they had, David Hasselhoff.
Yeah.
That's the other one you put in there.
Yeah,
because
yeah,
they both are very good at being kish about their own egos.
Right.
I really admire guys like that, that come off, you know, Kurt Russell has a lot of forward machismo, but then you watch his interviews and you realize, at least the way he portrays himself in his interviews, he's not really like that. It's more of a joke to him. So,
yeah. I mean, I must say, I do appreciate him as an actor. I think that, you know, most films that he is in, he elevates the characters that he portrays.
Sure.
And, you know, I think that it was the right choice in terms of a bit of a nostalgia kick, which, you know, The Guardians with its music and its, you know, references and stuff like that to Kevin Bacon and Footloose. And
well, and I think, you know, it's a really good point, because I think that's another reason it works so well, because the other thing that's in Guardians that isn't part of Guardians but has been made part of is James Gunn. Yeah. Like, the music, the references, like, the writing, that's him sitting down with his writing team and basically telling people how he wants. I mean, it's just so him. Mm. You know what I mean? The music especially. And it's just, it's one of those things that I think that's why I really like the MCUs. It's this wonderful pairing of great stories, along with great directors and great crew and great talent. Like, yeah, in my head, it's like, what else could you do for this? I'm like, somebody should do this with, like, Shakespeare or something. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, yeah. Just, I mean, there's
some other open free content that we could, you know, the reason it works is you have so much source material to play with, you know?
I think it's probably Kevin Feige's biggest success has been in, you know, getting the right director at the right time for the right project. Especially these, like you say, this kind of tail end of phase three. You know, going back to James Gunn and how he is kind of so much a part of the film. I love that opening sequence. I know I've talked about it like a million times to you, but, you know, just from a storytelling perspective, from a filmmaking perspective.
What I would really enjoy, Ed, because I wouldn't be able to do it, and I know you can. Can you give the audience here a little bit of a happy face here about the technical aspects that are so cool of it? Because, you know, the story element I got, and like the story element I kind of knew because I'd heard everyone hears about this opening scene, and I've kind of been done with it. And to be fair, the story element, I already knew what was going to happen. It was like, you know, like, this has been so overhyped. But then technically, it was so beautiful.
It was,
Man, it's such a well-gunned shot. But I don't know if you could, you know, in your own way, just walk through some of the better parts of that and why it's a good shot and why it works so well.
So just for you know, the basic premise, if for those of you that don't remember or haven't seen this and have decided to listen to this podcast, A, you're weirdos, but B, let me just walk you through it. The Guardians of the Galaxy have been hired by someone to protect these, like, batteries from this galactic space slug monster that's about to arrive. And Rocket is setting up some, like, hi-fi equipment so they can listen to music while they're fighting. And again, there's this great riff between Drax and then Quill and Gamora, and, you know, Quill is like, wait, you got a gun now? I thought guns were my thing. Great back and forth. But essentially, it goes into a single take of Groot, baby Groot, connecting the music up and the song starting. I can't remember what the name of the song is. But it's
Mr. Blue Sky.
Mr. Blue Sky. Very upbeat, very, you know, happy kind of music. And he proceeds to do a single take shot of Groot dancing around this platform whilst the Guardians of the Galaxy are fighting this, you know, interdimensional slug beast monster. Now, it's hilariously fun and cute. And James Gunn actually did the mocap for baby Groot doing the dancing. Which I think is hilarious as well. But I think it does a couple of things that, you know, we've seen in film before. You know, the famous single take shot in Goodfellas with Martin Scorsese, you know, that, you know, film fanatics love and talk about. So having that kind of sweeping, moving shot is a classic film thing. But what he's done, the layer that he added was the musical element, and also the special effects. The blending of special effects with the traditional moving camera technique, I think, is really what kind of took it to the next level. And also the fact that it wasn't taking itself too seriously. I think that that adds so much charm to, like, if you've got a bunch of filmmakers who are wearing berets and smoking French cigarettes, and they're doing, you know, the cinematic shot, it feels a little bit put on. But whereas with James Gunn, it feels very fresh and playful.
I really like the comment you made there, because that's, I mean, it's one thing, as I said, I'm becoming more of a filmmaker. I love being behind the camera. I just bought my first Panasonic G80 to get started with, because I'm just dying to shoot stuff around here. I live in a beautiful forest, so there's just lots to see around here. But yeah, the thing that gets me is sometimes when you're talking about camera technique, all of a sudden everybody gets so serious about things. Mm. And it's like, no, some of it's play, some of it's fun, and it's still going to tell your story in the way you want it to. But what he's talking about, so the single take bit, fine. You know what I mean? I think that was really cool and a really good idea, because what he's able to do with that, the fun part that sometimes is taken very seriously, like if you talk Citizen Kane, someone will be talking about this too, is the way he plays with the layers, the focus. It's one of the things that catches my eye all the time now, because I'm obsessed with it, just because I've seen it done now and I want to recreate it a bunch of times. But look at, you know, obviously you're following Baby Groot. And he's walking around in this big circle, and he's doing, from the get-go, it's the what is very popular in film right now. So if you're filming something right now, the most popular way to do close-ups is to do a close-up of someone really close to the camera, and then the background is out of focus, and you can kind of see what's going on. It has a lot of impact now, and everybody, it's like, it's been done so much that filmmakers now are like, Jesus, can we just stop doing so much of this? Like, can we just so... But he doesn't just stick with that, and that's where this is where he's showing his skills, because to do that, I have a real problem where they do that blankly everywhere, because sometimes there are cues in the background that you need people to see. Sometimes you want to divert attention away from the person doing this, and that's what James Gunn does. When something's happening in the background and it's important, he's going to off focus, you know, off focus Groot, and show you really quickly what's going on. And then he may move the camera so the focus goes back to the way it should be. That's what I thought was so clever. So Baby Groot's going to go out of focus because we need to see what's happening behind, but then Baby Groot's going to move towards the action and everything goes back into focus. Other times, you know, screw the fact that we can't see behind him. He's going to put the whole scene in focus, and you see this absolutely massive monster in the background just decimating somebody. I mean, that's the stuff that shows what a good filmmaker he is versus someone who would have just shot that all the way around, maybe not a continuous take, and just had Baby Groot really close with stuff going on in the background, and you can kind of figure out what's going on. That's the difference between a good shot and a great shot.
And again, I mean, you know, we're talking about like a big blockbuster with lots of special effects and stuff like that. And that is a very difficult style of filmmaking, you know, like there's a lot of really great filmmakers who, if asked to do that, would struggle.
No. And that's what I mean, because again, with the credits, this is one of those credits for it, because we have 6 or 7 VFX houses kind of doing it all together, which I think is awesome. Power to you guys. But it goes on forever. And that would have meant James Gunn, though. The other thing that Ed was pointing out with traditional camera techniques, that's not something that James was filming. He had to go to these VFX houses. And I can't remember which one does that scene, but it's one of the more famous ones, of course. Maybe Wax, possibly. But, you know, he has to go to them and say, you're going to have to do it this way. You know, that requires even more skill, because he's not only got to know what he wants to do with the camera, visualize it in his head, and then he's got to tell the VFX tech how to do it and say, okay, so here Groot's got to be in focus, and here Groot's got to be out of focus. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, that's genius. Like, that's not something that you could just do sitting down. You'd have to think about that in depth. And I just really applaud that. It's the type of stuff I go giddy over. Like, that's, if you want to know how I'm making films these days, that's the kind of stuff. I see a shot I like, and I'm going to sit there, and I'm going to, you know, poke around with it as long as I can to make it as good as it can. And I just, that's why I think it's an important message for indie filmmakers. Like, guys, this is how you take things to the next level. And that's what I mean. What James did was really cool because of all the money, but you don't need the money to do that. You just need the thought to say, I have an idea of how I want the shot to look, and I don't want it to look just like everyone else. Sorry, that's my rant, Ed.
Cool.
What other things put you off about the film? I'm still interested, because nothing you've said so far has really been like, ooh, well, that's it. What other moments do you remember offhand that you didn't like about this?
I remember when they first arrive at Ego's planet, there's a lot of, you know, color and, you know, images on screen, which I know are supposed to be very enticing, but I found that section a little bit dull. I thought that the film slowed down a lot. And
it's interesting because there were a bunch of cuts to that as well. Mm. So in the deleted scenes, there's a statue made of Peter Quill,
mm-hmm.
By Ego, and they kind of just walk by it. And of course, Gamora is just rolling her eyes, and Peter's like, "Oh, well, it's my planet now."
Mm.
That was cut out exactly for what you said, James. In the commentary, just says it's too long. Like it just was delaying things, and I needed them to get to where they were going.
That it's the curse of the second act, though, isn't it? Like it just always is gonna be. It's gonna slow down. And with a film like Guardians of the Galaxy that relies a lot on its kind of, you know, speed and freneticism, I think it's a difficult hurdle to overcome.
Sure.
And I think he recovers really, really well, because, you know, when the third act really gets going, once, you know, Peter realizes who Ego, or, you know, what Ego's really been doing and stuff. You can't take your eyes off the screen. Really?
No. Once the reveal is done and all that, yeah, you're like, wow.
When the realization comes, you're like, holy shit. Yeah.
So reel me this. Well, because we're getting towards the end of the show here, and I, as I said, I've done way too much research on these folks as far as watching commentary and behind the scenes. But one of the things they reveal, talking about the writing of this, and it's the scene before what you're talking about, is the scene where they make the decision to go see Ego.
Mm.
Ego lands. Originally. And this is just kind of what if. Originally, the scene was flipped. And so in that scene, Gamora is pushing Peter to go and saying, you have to go see your father. And that's, according to James Gunn, it was necessary, because later on, it's going to be necessary to reverse everything and make it Gamora's fault that he went out there. He said, originally, of course, it was the other way, where Peter's like, I've got to go see my dad. You know what I mean? Like, I've got to go see this. Do you think Act 2 would have been a bit faster? And I'm just wondering, because it might have been, if Peter Quill had been the one that has the impetus to go see his father.
I don't think so. I think that the dramatic tension that is set up by Gamora being the one who's trying to talk him into going makes Act 3 much more interesting. So I don't, and possibly it's the kind of thing that. It's those kinds of decisions that I think you really have to be in the room, in the edit room, when they're being made, or in the writer's room, because, you know, it can change everything. And, you know, motivations for characters doing certain things it's one of the hardest things, especially with superhero films, as you will, you know, see later in the MCU, kind of canon, close to the end of Phase 3, particularly with Star-Lord. Oh, god damn it.
Yeah, you know, I think I know what you're talking about with that. Like,
yeah.
I've seen Infinity Wars, that was shocking. You're like, what?
Yeah.
That segues nicely into what I think would be the final set of questions, but your views on that unspoken thing.
Hmm.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
All right. So how are your views on that? How do you, that portrayal, what do you think?
I love it because, again, it's a pop culture reference to an 80s where he literally, you know, says Sam and Diane from Cheers. Will they, won't they? You know, which is so, I can't imagine them not having had a note from a producer saying, couldn't we make it like, you know, Ross and Rachel, or like a more contemporary reference or something like that? And no, because that is the exact, I think, a romantic in the 80s, right, who pined for, you know, the boombox outside the window kind of stuff, and that those kind of really angsty 80s. Kind of love things for a kid who grew up with that, and that's his only kind of frame of reference. I think that it makes the unspoken thing much more powerful. But I'm a kid from the 80s. Like, I am the age of Peter Quill, more or less, right? We both are, right? And so the idea that, you know, we grew up with in terms of what is romance and unrequited love and will they, won't they, I think it's a great device.
I think one of the things I get mad about, and this is, you know, it's funny, you mentioned Say Anything. I would mention another John Cusack film, High Fidelity, and I think I've referenced it on this podcast. You know,
did it in a top five, I think, didn't we?
Was it the sad CDs that made me, you know, a hopeless romantic, or the fact that I was a hopeless romantic led me to listen to sad CDs?
Right.
You wonder if the art imitates life or life imitates art. Here, this is an archetype of a relationship, and I just love it. Like, I just think because, I don't know, maybe it's because I'm an American guy married to an English girl. Like, you know what I mean? Like, yes, like real love, guys, like, is like that. Like, it's like you just have that some unspoken thing. Like, I don't know how to explain it any more than that. But the way it's portrayed in the film, I just wanted to ask your views on it. Because for me, that's probably one of the strongest parts of Guardians for me, is like the fact that these two love each other. They know they love each other. It's just they have such different ways of expressing it. You know what I mean? Like, they have such different ways of dealing with it. And you know, you have Gamora, who is the, you know, she's had that kind of life and she's got to stay strong. You know what I mean? And can't bend to any weak mortal or anything like that. But then you've got Peter Quill, who's like just been on the edge of his seat his whole life. He's just like, I got to take a chance. And, you know, he's mortified when, as I said, it's one of the funniest scenes. But, you want to have sexual relations with this one? Yeah. Shut up, Drax. But, you know, he's like that. He's like a little kid, like a puppy dog that's in love with this woman. And
I love that because, you know, in the first one, he's portrayed very like in a Kirk kind of will.
Yeah,
you know, burn anything
that's what
that
I mean.
Moves.
Like, it evolves in the second one where you start understanding like this isn't him trying to like land a girl. He's in love with her. Like, he doesn't know what to do because he's got no way of really. She's not the loving type, you know, she just doesn't. It's not her thing.
She's
so got kind of.
She's not a dancer. Again,
and that's where you.
Drax's stories.
No, exactly. But to me, that is the quintessential what makes Peter Quill a real romantic, as opposed to a wannabe romantic. Opposed to someone that just beds women to lay them. Like, this is him showing like he really does care. Like, and I don't know. When you can connect like that with a character, you're like, that's really cool.
Another moment where Drax just killed me is where he's like, my father would recite how he impregnated my mother every winter solstice. And Quill's like, that's gross, man. And Drax is like, oh, it's beautiful. Humans have such hang-ups. I love
so
Drax.
True, though. It's so true, right?
Yeah, like, it is.
Don't get me wrong. That's not an invitation, Mom, to start telling me your sex stories. But you know what I mean? What are you guys talking about?
What are you guys talking about?
But yeah, I mean, that's why I love Guardians. It explores those kind of things. Like, I just think it explores a lot of realizations we are only having now in like a postmodern world. One, about how romance really is. It's not like it is in the movies. But we should make movies about it, because why make movies that aren't real? You know what I mean? Or at least that aren't, you know, accurate as to how we perceive love. And, you know, the Drax thing, like, why do we have all these hangups about so many things? Mm. Like, is it really all that big of a deal? And yeah, James just is able to touch on all of those things in a 2-hour film and then make you smile at the end. And that's why, I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, what else can I say except that he's...
Like, it's an ensemble film, right? Like, it's obviously, you know...
Yeah, it shouldn't work. It shouldn't... You shouldn't be crying at
the end. There's so many characters, like Rocket Raccoon and
his... It should be
his,
like Justice League, where you were like...
Arc. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Where you were just like, you really liked the fact that they tried, but you're like, but it's just too many people on the
screen.
Yeah,
too many people. No one's really getting to shine.
Yeah, watch Justice League and then go watch Aquaman. And you'll be like, wow. Like, those are two different films. Justice League wasn't a bad film. It just, it had too much going on in it. You know, it was like, you know, and has that horrible DC, I call it the DCEU. I don't know why, but the DCEU extended universe or European Union.
I think it is extended universe.
I think so. But you know, whoever designed that story with the whole, like, let's just, first of all, like, if you're going to do the death of Superman the way it was done in the comic books, it was done in the comic books. Like,
what do you think of this whole Snyder Cut? Have we talked about the Snyder Cuts?
We haven't. We'll watch it. We can talk about it on the air, because I don't see how it could be that. Listen, Zack Snyder is not, and I feel horrible saying this because the tragedy you experienced in your life, man, I'm sure if we sat down and talked, we'd have lots to discuss. Exactly. We could probably make some cool films together. But the films that you make and the way you look at film is just not the way I do. When you talked about like the coolest, but some of the comments you made, I just didn't agree with. Let's go that far. Because again, I'm basing on what this guy says on Twitter or on a news pod. And right. I don't know you, man. And if you want to get to know us, come on the show. You know what I mean? We'll talk to you.
Zack Snyder.
You know what I mean? We'd love
what
to, you know,
talking about?
Love to interview you. But point being, like he said, like I think I told you, it was the thing he was talking about Batman. And Batman at the time he made this comment was like the thing for me. Like I thought Batman was the coolest archetype character. Now we've kind of moved on, but he said like Batman would be really cool if it was like Batman got raped in prison, and that's why he's so tough. And to me, it was like you fundamentally don't understand Batman then. Like, and I know I'm that guy, and I go on the show, Zach, and tell people that are these guys, and be like, "Fuck you! Like, stop arguing about something that's not real." But it's just, it permeated so far into that film. It permeated into Watchmen. And it was like, Watchmen was the one that could have worked because that is a depressing graphic novel. The whole point is it's dystopian.
Have you
it's
seen just, the TV show
yet? No, which wasn't done by him. No. But it's a direct sequel to the book, not the movie. It skips over that. And I do own it. I bought it for my birthday. I bought a ton of stuff from iTunes just as like my own little, you know, present to myself. And that was one of the things I bought. I bought that in Chernobyl, and I watched the first three episodes of Chernobyl, realizing that I needed to like get the metal to watch the whole thing because it's slow.
I haven't worked up the courage to.
No, it's not a bad one at all. It's just it's very much like Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. Yes, like I have to be ready for the Iron Curtain.
In the mood, right? Yeah, it's just ready for the Iron Curtain. I love that.
Yeah, because communist Russia didn't die because it was like not feeding its people. It didn't die because of the corruption. It died because when it's taken into film, sometimes it's the most utterly fucking boring thing in the world. Like the colors are the most like boring colors you'll ever see. And I get it. It's communism. You're supposed to be like as plain and proletariat as possible. It's why if this uprising ever happens, I will be the first guy killed because I want colors. You know what I mean?
Like, have you ever seen there's a great German TV show. It's called Deutschland 83.
No.
That's really, really good. It's about an East German spy. Who's sent to West Germany.
Oh, wow.
And it actually has quite a lot of very up-tempo editing to it, and it's a very, very cool show.
Yeah,
but there's so many... Deutschland 83, yeah. There's so many, like, you know, there's no doubting that the MCU over the past, like, 10, 15 years had a massive impact on our entertainment. You look at The Boys, you look at Watchmen, you look at all the things that have kind of followed suit from, you know, the popularity of the MCU. And I think that this film, The Guardians of the Galaxy, maybe this series, is perhaps the one that has reached the furthest outside of, you know, the traditional confines of,
the comic book movie and stuff like that. The most appeal. Partly because of an ensemble cast, the benefit you always have with that is that, you know, if you have a good director, and this is why he's doing Suicide Squad, because the original Suicide Squad, wasn't a bad film. Again, a lot of people hate it. I don't. I think it's decent. However, you can't really connect. The problem you have is you have, again, Harley Quinn is the only character that you feel connected with. Mm. And you kind of want to learn more about the Joker, but he's not in the movie long enough for you to know anything about him, right? Mm. Everybody else is kind of like Killer Croc. You're like, hi, Killer Croc. You know what I mean?
Boomerang.
I found even Birds of Prey had more that you wanted, like the Huntress in that, who only shows up. That's Elizabeth Winstead, is her name?
Yes, Elizabeth.
Elizabeth Mary Winstead, one of my favorite actresses. Ramona Flowers. Yes. Oh my God, you're so cool. But as the Huntress, she's really good, but she doesn't have a whole lot of parts. But when she's there, you're interested in her character. Problem you had, you know, with everything else was like just unrememberable characters. I think that's why James Gunn's gone on to Suicide Squad, because they're like, well, he did it in Guardians of the Galaxy. Every single person has a favorite.
If he does it with Suicide Squad, man, like,
oh, he will. He absolutely will. It's a great.
Okay, so who is your favorite character in this film?
Rocket.
Yes. Thank you. And you know what? We've kind of not talked a lot about him. But what a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant arc.
Rocket is my inner me.
I get
it. Like, Rocket for me, I'm always really pissed off about something. It's because I have a lot of thing unresolved issue, okay? I don't show a lot of people that. Ed knows it. My wife knows it. People who know me know it because they see it. doesn't come out very often. Otherwise, I have, you know, in general, a fuck it attitude. It's very much like, I'm going to do what I want. But that's, you know, my wife is the first one to figure out that that's kind of a ruse. Like, that's because sometimes I just don't want to deal with people. And so I'm just mean to them, so they go away. Yeah. And so, yeah, that's why I like rock. I didn't know we were going to turn this into another psychologist couch session. Yeah? Not my fault.
No, but he is very, very good. And again, man, like, I mean, who'd have thunk it, right? What's the name of the actor who voices Rocket?
That's Bradley Cooper.
Bradley Cooper, that's right, yeah. Who'd have thought it, right? Like,
He's such one of those. I feel always bad about Bradley Cooper because in my own prejudice, let's just call it what it is. My own prejudice against kind of what's going on right now, and there's a lot of flack against white people. Like, I did peg him in there, and I was like, listen, you know, you're not that great of an actor. You get these roles because you're a good-looking white guy, and you must have talked really well in Hollywood because you get all these good roles. And consistently, I see his stuff, and I'm like, you're an asshole for ever saying that about him. He is such a good actor. You know what I mean? Like,
he's a lot
so
of fun, man.
Talented, you know, very, very so talented. Versatile. You know, you see him in that, and then he's in, you know, he's with Lady Gaga in such a great film there, and Silver Linings Playbook.
I still haven't seen that. Yeah, yeah.
But he can also play a douchebag. He plays the douchebag in Wedding Crashers. He's the other dude there. You know what I mean? He's done horror. You know what I mean? Like, he just has a good roster.
Proper, yeah, and he's a proper, like, jobbing actor as well. Like, he works.
Yeah, I think that's, wow, it's funny you say that. Yeah, because I'm starting to wonder why all actors aren't like that. You know what I mean? Like, people kind of make fun of the Morgan Freemans and the Bradley Coopers and the Sam Jacksons of the world. And it's like, don't you want to get paid? Like, you know what I mean? Like, if someone's willing to pay you, don't get me wrong, you have to live with your stinkers. But MCU is a great example of how you can live with stinkers, okay? It's the only thing I wanted to add to what Ed was talking about. Yes, they have influenced pop culture, probably for the better, and for the rest, they definitely influenced cinematic culture. You know, in the way we go to cinema, in the way we look at putting together stories, but they did that. What really gets me about that is people forget that there were a number of stinkers in this, especially in the early days. Like, this was not a for sure deal at all. And everybody says, well, he must have just known. Fuck you, he knew. He didn't know shit. He just felt this is what he had to do. And sorry I had to say it with so much swear words, but that's what people don't get about film. Like, there's never going to be this point where it's all going to just be like, look on paper and be like, oh my God, we're going to make $1 million.
We've
like,
done it.
Yeah. That's it. We've done it. We've done it. We've solved it on paper, people. This is amazing. Like, no, you just have to turn to someone, look them straight in the eye and be like, it's going to work. Okay. It's going to work.
I don't know what's going to happen.
No, that's what you say. I'm the producer. So I look them straight in the eye and say, it's going to work. Get your ass out there. Film it. Let's do it. Let's go. Let's go. Let's go. That's what I mean. Like, you have to trust your vision. And that's why Kevin Feige is so amazing. And Jon Favreau is another one that we hold up there, because when it comes to trusting vision and executing on that and getting results from pop culture, that's it. Did Kevin give up when they didn't get the deals they wanted on the first phase? No, he just said, you know what, we're going to have to rejig this a bit. And you know, probably had a lot of sleepless nights with the whole thing. However, I think now he can sit back, rest, and say, wow, I've done it. You know what I mean?
I think the crowning glory, you know, and we talked a little bit about Homecoming, that was a big moment. Getting creative control of Spider-Man back was huge. And then, obviously, Disney turning around and saying, you know what? We're going to buy Fox and all their properties, and we're going to reunite a lot of the Marvel stuff. I think that is, you know, the money people backing him and saying, we believe in you, Kevin.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's important to understand when we talk about that, it's not just that he went to on the Spider-Man story and he says, oh, I got a great story here. Like, no, this is what we mean when we talk about production. Like, he is hammering this on all angles. He's saying, listen, not only does it make sense to the fans, I can show you on the money side of things why this is going to work for you, because you're going to make the films and I'm going to get the talent. And we're going to make sure that we make a ton of money off these, because between the two of our two studios, why wouldn't we be able to do this, you know, properly? But you can clearly see it, and I guess watching the behind the scenes does help a bit. Not as much as you'd think, because remember, Marvel behind the scenes are actually, aside from director's commentary and aside from those elements, they are quite light when it comes to talking about the financing of their films, how things are coming together. But you can clearly see that he's brokered so many deals in doing this, that he is not just a good story man, that he's an excellent producer, that he knows how to get people to agree things. And I think that's where the comparisons start with the other franchises, and where you start saying, is this something that could be imported in over to the Star Wars universe to give them a better leg up. I'm not saying replace Kathleen Kennedy. I'm just saying have her sit with Kevin and, you know, figure out what Kevin did to help get all these different parties on the same page, because that's the problem you're having. And that's why this has never been attempted before. I've heard about this in previous discussions. Hell, back when I worked at Suncoast Video, Adam Brown, we love you, man. Back when I worked at Suncoast Video, I worked with two guys that were working on a G.I. Joe franchise that they could never get off the ground because there just wasn't the backing for it. People just didn't agree that it would work. Now, you're going to be hard-pressed not to try to, you know, not to have these elements baked into any kind of fantasy or sci-fi thing you're thinking about. You've got to have, you know, Dune, I am sure, they're like, it's the Dune universe, you know what I mean? Like, we're going to have 12 films, you know what I mean? So... that's all I'm saying. Like, it's amazing to see how this came together in the MCU. I think Guardians, you are correct, is probably one of the pinnacles of that. As far as reaching a fan base, I don't, you know, we didn't pull up the numbers for this one. And we apologize for that. It's just not something we did for this one. It's because they're going to be so god awfully amazing anyway. But this would have been one on, you know, they hit so many milestones. This would have been one of their top tens, you know, top tens of all time. So yeah. So I think we've talked it to death. We're going to pick it up again when we get maybe to Infinity Wars, because I'm, you know, we're pretty sure I'm going to get really mad at Infinity Wars. It's going to kill everybody. And I'm be like, what was the point of me watching all those films where you saved everybody?
No.
See, I remember. I remember being in the theater, and because I hadn't watched all the MCU films, I was just like, why are they killing everybody? Like, are they going to bring them back? Like, wait, what? What's going on? And the thing is, I do know because I read comic books, or I used to, and I read them again now, like, this is what they do in comics. They lay out everybody,
right,
and then they'll pick them back slowly. The ones that don't do that.
It's just that it's the first time they're really doing this in the cinematic universe.
Right. So the shock is there.
It's
like,
the shock. Yeah.
And to be fair, it wasn't the first time they did it. Can you remember? And this is a good trivia question to end on. Because I know the answer and you don't, and you hate when I do this.
I fucking hate this, but go on.
You really, really hate when I do this. Do you know the other film they did do this in, though? That they eliminated a vast majority of the cast before the end of the film? I'll give you a hint. It's a Marvel film.
Yeah.
Marvel Universe.
Yeah. But is it like going to be a really obscure one?
Nope.
It's not Fantastic Four.
Nope. It did tank a franchise at the time. The franchise had to be rebooted after this.
Can't remember.
X-Men. So X-Men The Last Stand.
When Jean Grey,
the original Phoenix Saga, because they kind of slated it into this third X-Men. I actually kind of like that X-Men because it's so weird and wonky.
No, Brett Ratner is just...
No, I don't know. What did he do? Did he do something bad?
I mean, he's just the king of hacks, but...
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I was just saying, like, is he like a pedophile or something? Because that happens
No.
That happens all the time now. We're like, man, that guy's awesome. And you're like, dude, he was a pedophile. You're like, oh, my bad. Or, dude, he raped that girl. You're like, oh, my bad. Really, my bad.
I think he was kind of, you know, involved in the whole Me Too thing. But
Last Stand, so it does what comic books do, and that's why it was so poorly received. Because Xavier, obviously, I think people can remember that he's pixelated off the screen. He's just wiped out. But basically every X-Men, you know, the first one to die is Cyclops, and that's the one that kind of shocks you because, again, it's because at the end of 2, you had this really long rescue scene. And you never wonder, what's the point of saving them all at the end of 2 if you're just going to kill them all in 3? And that's what happens. He kills the vast majority of the X-Men, which is how it's done in the X-Men. And it's set up to a new universe. They've killed Professor Xavier 7 billion times. Professor Xavier's been the villain some of the times. Like, it's just how many times they've reiterated that universe.
It's a comic, you know, it's definitely a comic book trope that it's going to be interesting to see what they do. To, you know, build back up to another Avengers film later down the line or what have you. Obviously Kevin's got a plan, right?
No, the plan is, so far the rumors that are coming out, they're going to do Secret Wars, which is a really good, I haven't read that one yet. But when it was out, people went mental about it. You know, just
it was really cool. Fun. Really, I think
that's, they are talking about bringing Robert Downey Jr. back, play in a Secret Wars style.
I mean, I always knew that the money would just be way too good for him to say no.
Yeah, it's just like those bands that retire. Like, you can't... That's the only problem you run with cinema that's done this way. And I'm sure Kevin's got a plan, but, like, it is like the bands, okay? The bands all ended in the 80s. Said, this is our last reunion tour. It's 92. And the problem has, and trust me, man, some of these guys are my friends, like, they wake up and they're like, oh, crap.
make a living, right?
I'm not gonna mortgage, or I'm not gonna my taxes this year. You know what I mean? So what are we gonna do? And they call their agent. The first thing the agent's gonna say is just go back on tour, you idiot.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So that's what they do. So Robert Downey Jr., I don't think he's ever gonna be hurting for money, but you know, maybe he wants to do it again. Maybe he just is bored. You know, he'll get back into this. He is the linchpin that kind of made this along with Kevin Feige. So it's gonna be very difficult for him to kind of, you know, completely erase himself for it. I get people that want to pause out of it and say, you know, I get all the people in Star Wars that are like, I just don't want to do another Luke Skywalker again. Like, I get that. That's fine. Done tons of them. But for everyone else, it's like, trust me, man, you're a working actor. You got to make money. Like, you're up one day, you're down the next. So,
amen.
So anywho, we're going to wrap it to a close now. Thank you so much for joining us for this three-peat of the MCU. Like I said, I'm going to lay off, just like we're talking about actors laying off things, I'm going to lay off the MCU with you guys. You'll see some blog posts, but otherwise, lay off it for a while. I believe next week we will talk Fright Fest. That's what I was talking about with Ed, to say, can you pick a movie? If not, we'll have something else lined up for you. As I said, we are talking to Adam Stovall tomorrow for his film A Ghost Waits. We
super
have not
excited
just
for that.
Yeah, so is he, and so is everybody else, because we have, like, I asked him, what do you want to talk about? And he's like, well, what do you want to talk about? And I was like, that's the show. We just kind of talk. And he's like, awesome. So I will ask him some questions about the film. He's from the same hometown as me, guys. So we are going to have loads of Cincinnati
bullshit.
Basically,
just going to list the best places to eat in Cincinnati. That's what
we might do. It's definitely going to be a lot of that. There's
top
definitely
five
a lot
places
of
to eat in Cincinnati.
And just warning Ed, like, there's going to be a lot of tutting, because this is what happened when my wife's around with somebody who's from my hometown. And I just, because I'm already a motor mouth, but it's like, it's not that I don't think you're
in
the room.
I'm looking forward to it, man. I'm looking forward to you slipping right into, like, Cincy, you know, like, proper
native.
What did
it say? Dialect. I was about to say, there's no native dialect. So, and the worst thing is, I mean, Adam and I don't know each other that well. So I had to ask him, I'd be like, is there anything you don't want me to talk about? Because, like, you know, I can be kind of abrasive. So I'm a bit nervous. I don't want to piss him off or anything. We'll see how it goes.
Don't worry. He'll love me. So
what? Exactly. Like, that's the best part. If I completely choke up and shy my way through it, Ed will have his beautifully posh English voice to guide us through to the end. So,
y'all's darling.
All right. Thank you all very much for listening. Continue to listen to us on SoundCloud or on our new home, which is going to be Anchor FM, coming soon. Please check us out at www.victoriaproductions.com and all the social media sites that we have on Instagram, social media through Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. Thank you so much for listening. I said we'll be back next week with more craziness in your face. Until then,
thank you. Bye.
Listen to